This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Medical News. We're about to speak to Dr. Rick Haupt at Merck. Welcome to Utopia Medical News.
Thank you, Mark.
Tell us what your position is and what your responsibilities are there at Merck.
I am executive medical director in a department that, in the Merck Vaccine Division called Policy, Public Health, and Medical Affairs. And my responsibilities include medical affairs and policy issues related to Gardasil, which is Merck's quadrivalent human papillomavirus vaccine.
Okay, tell us what Gardasil does.
Gardasil is a quadrivalent vaccine that includes four HPV types that cause infection of the genital region, and these are we targeted the four types that cause most clinical disease around the world, and those are types 16 and 18, which cause 70% of the cervical cancers, and then as well as high-grade cervical precancers, and then also we've included 6 and 11, which cause the majority, about 90% of genital warts. They also cause some, maybe 10% of low-grade cervical precancers, and 6 and 11 also cause a vocal cord infection called recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. So what we demonstrated in our clinical trials in over 27,000 subjects in 33 countries was that in women who were not yet infected with those four types and received three doses of our vaccine over a period of about a year, we saw virtually 100% protection against infection as well as disease caused by those HPV types.
Tell us how prevalent these diseases are in the U.S. and worldwide.
Sure. Genital HPV, now there are many types. There are probably close to 40 different types of HPV that infect the genital region. And the family, if you will, of those types probably represent the most frequent and common sexually transmitted infection worldwide. In the United States, data from the CDC suggests that there are 5 to 6 million new infections with genital HPV every year, and the lifetime risk for a woman to get infected with one of these HPV types by the time she turns 50 is about 80%. So it's a very, very prevalent and high incident infection as well. And the reason for that, although HPV, genital HPV, is considered sexually transmitted, very different than many of the other sexually transmitted infections, is that the mode of transmission requires just intimate contact with the genital region. So HPV, the virus types are all over the genital skin area as well as in the mucous membranes, but they can be transmitted through intimate genital to genital skin contact. So the transmission rates are much, or the transmission ease is much greater with HPV, and it leads to such a high prevalence.
When did Merck set out to create a vaccine against these human papillomavirus?
Well, the story goes back prior to Merck when independent investigators and researchers obviously recognized in the probably starting in the late 70s and 80s, it was recognized that there were certain strains of HPV that could cause cancer. And these so-called high-risk strains were identified in virtually 100% of all cervical cancers. So it was realized that if you could prevent infection with these strains, you could potentially prevent cervical cancer. And then other investigators noticed that if they could identify the protein that defined the different types, and that protein would self-assemble itself into what's called a virus-like particle, and that virus-like particle would be proved to be very immunogenic. So Merck got involved in developing these virus-like particles into a vaccine in about the mid-90s, in the early to mid-90s. So our clinical program, basically goes back to about the mid-90s, I would say.
Okay. Talking sort of intelligent layman's terms about how the vaccine works to confer immunity.
Sure. It turns out that these virus-like particles, when they're administered as a vaccine in a series of three doses, are highly immunogenic. They are, in fact, they elicit an immune response that's greater than what we see with natural infection, significantly so. And so what was demonstrated very early on was that administration of virus-like particles would cause a very potent immunological response with the development of specific, what we call neutralizing antibodies. These are antibodies that, you know, by the term neutralizing, they attack the virus and they don't allow the virus to be able to gain hold to the cells in the body, and they prevent infection. And so basically, through the administration of the vaccine, Gardasil, we elicit a strong immune response with circulating antibodies that prevent infection when the person is exposed to the same types of HPV through natural exposure means.
Okay. Does this treatment have, as you've tested it so far, have any unwanted side effects that patients need to monitor themselves for?
We always obviously look for unintended consequences of drugs or vaccines. So no therapeutic or preventative intervention is without is completely without risk. The main thing we saw, basically, Gardasil proved itself to be very well tolerated. We, as with many vaccines, the most common reaction we saw were just local reactions at the injection site. So many people will get a bit of a sore arm and maybe some swelling or redness at the site. That's a very common reaction to most vaccines. By injecting, you know, a needle into somebody's muscle or skin, you're going to cause some irritation. So that's the most common thing we saw. We saw a small number of people had fevers after vaccination and had some headaches, and we saw very, very rare, if any, really more serious reactions. In fact, in the course of our clinical trials, the women who were in the studies had a very, very low discontinuation rate because of any kind of adverse event. So the vaccine was very well tolerated. We obviously will be putting together surveillance programs in the post-licensure time period to follow safety and effectiveness of the vaccine once it starts to be used in millions of people instead of thousands who are studying the clinical trial. But we saw very, very little in the way of side effects.
You mentioned the three separate inoculations. What's the timing of them?
Our recommended timing is to give three doses at 0, 2, and 6 months. That means 0 would be the first one, and then the second dose around 2 months later, and the third dose 6 months after after that first dose. It turns out that we have a fair amount of good information to suggest that there is some flexibility around those dosing time periods. And in fact, in our per-protocol efficacy that I mentioned to you, that almost 100% protection, those women, by definition, got three doses over about a year's time period. And so even in our FDA package insert, there's a table that specifies that the second dose can be given plus or minus 1 month around that two-month period, and the third dose can be given plus or minus 2 months around that six-month time period. And the immunogenicity and efficacy is not affected by that flexibility.
Okay, you can't tell for sure yet, but how long do you imagine the immunity conferred by this treatment course will last?
You're right. We don't know for sure at this time. As with any new vaccine, we are limited in our knowledge of the duration of immune response by what our current information is at the time it's licensed. So we know, based on our data and our length of study, that we have very high levels of protection at 5 years, and that's the limit of our knowledge to date. We also have information that suggests that the vaccine elicits a very strong immune memory response, meaning that the body, when it got those three doses, has sort of memorialized the immune response, and then and we've demonstrated that when we've challenged women 5 years later with an additional dose, they had a very rapid immune response. So we are hopeful that the duration will be quite significant, but we don't know. But what's important is that we have set up surveillance systems to follow that over time. And that's a responsibility that a vaccine manufacturer will undertake, in that we must you know, make sure that we put systems in place to follow the vaccine. So we have some surveillance programs that will allow us to look at the duration of the immune response over time, and those surveillance systems involve women who were in our clinical trials already 3 years ahead of the general population that would be vaccinated. So we have this cohort of women who are 3 to 4 years ahead of the rest of the population that will help us to define if there's a booster necessary. It would be, we would know it well in advance of most people are getting the vaccine now that the vaccine is licensed.
Now, you mentioned that a preponderance of women will have this infection by the time they're 50. Is there any clinical benefit from having the vaccine after infection, or is that pointless?
Yeah, we have no clear evidence that the vaccine has any therapeutic impact on the four types that are in Gardasil. So the nature of the immune response is such that Gardasil is designed to be a prophylactic or a preventative vaccine. So it works the best if given to people prior to them being exposed to one of those four types. Now, it's important to recognize that when I said that 80% of women are at risk of being infected with a general HPV type by the age of 50, remember that applies to all 40 types. And clearly the highest age group that is exposed to HPV and when they are recognized to be, have the highest exposure to infection are people beginning their life in some kind of sexual experience. So the teens and 20s are the sort of target age to try to make sure that the vaccine is given to, because many of those individuals, even the women who are sexually active, have not yet been exposed to any of, or any, let alone even a few of the types in Gardasil. So there's still great value in vaccinating even sexually active women that we studied in that, 16 to 26-year-old. But clearly, women who are already infected with one of the types in our vaccine, we don't see clear benefit in a therapeutic way.
Okay. How uneventful was the licensing by the FDA? When was that finally announced?
The FDA licensed Gardasil on June 8th of this year, so a little over a month ago. When you ask how uneventful it was, there was a long period of time that we've provided information to them. The FDA, as you probably are aware, did a priority review of our file, so they reviewed the comprehensive database over about a 6-month time period. They worked extraordinarily hard, and I think that as a testament to the breadth of our data, the FDA's advisory committee recommended unanimously for approval, and the FDA 2 to 3 weeks following that advisory committee made approval for the vaccine for all the women that were in our study group, which was the 9 through 26-year-old female. So although it seemed uneventful in a sense, it was certainly a lot of work went into that, great and very appropriate result.
Now, pretty soon after the FDA approval, the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Policy, also issued an announcement about Gardasil. What did they say?
Yeah, that was on June 29th, so it was exactly 3 weeks later. And again, although that date they were ready to make that recommendation because it was now following licensure of the product, they were gathering, the ACIP was gathering information on HPV and Gardasil and health economics of HPV vaccination over the last 2 to 3 years. So they've been working very hard to get to the point where they could make a recommendation as quickly following licensure as possible.
Tell people a little about what that committee is.
Sure. The ACIP stands for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It's a federal advisory committee mandated by U.S. Congress. And it's composed of 15 voting members who are basically some of our nation's experts on vaccines, and they make recommendations for the use of vaccines that determine what's the appropriate use of vaccines for best public health.
Okay, what was their recommendation? situation?
Sure. They recommended, they had, they called out two age groups that they wanted to recommend. They wanted to say, first of all, that all females 11 to 12 years of age should get the vaccine routinely. Also, in that age group, they also said that the vaccine could be given as early as 9 years of age, because that's the age we were indicated down to. And then they also said that all 13 to 26-year-old females should be routinely vaccinated also, if they haven't already received the vaccine. Their statement said that although the vaccine is better to give to someone who is not sexually active, that even women who are sexually active should still be vaccinated. And then they had a series of special situations that they wanted to really express, pointedly make an issue that you still should vaccinate in these special situations. So they said women who've had abnormal pap should still get the vaccine, women who've had genital warts should still get the vaccine, women who've had HPV testing in the past that was positive should also still get the vaccine. And they wanted to make it clear to providers and to public health community and to consumers that there was value in vaccinating a very broad group of women across the entire age group that we studied.
So the idea is that this is acquired through sexual activity, but it's not necessarily immediately acquired in all its forms through sexual activity, and therefore there's a benefit for applying the treatment for women who are already sexually active.
Yeah, because remember that women who are already sexually active are at risk of being exposed to any one of 40 general HPV types. And even though the four types that in Gardasil are the most prevalent and cause most disease, there's still opportunity to vaccinate sexually active women because they may not have been exposed to one of those or any of those types in the vaccine. In fact, our studies suggested that over 90% of women who are sexually active in our trial would benefit from protection against 3 to 4 types. So only about 7% of the women in our trial at baseline before they entered the study were infected with 2 or more types. So they would benefit from protection against at least 3, and in most cases actually would benefit from protection against all 4 types. 3/4 of the women in our study were negative to all 4 types in Gardasil and therefore would be prevented from infection with those 4 types. We also showed that if you were infected with one type, say type 6, the vaccine's efficacy against the other 3 was virtually unaffected by that. So there was, again, if you're infected with one type, you get prevention against the other 3. And that's why the ACIP issued such a strong, broad recommendation.
Now, this is a quadrivalent vaccine because it protects against 4 types of the virus. From my calculations, there are another 36 out there, which obviously have less significance but some significance. Are there plans afoot? Is it feasible to create a 40-valent vaccine that would protect against all these types, all the known types?
I think what we recognize, of those 40, probably somewhere between 12 and 15 are cancer-causing strains. 16 and 18 are the most important. They cause about 70% of all cervical cancers. The next most important type is probably type 45, which causes maybe about 5% of cervical cancers around the world. Then there's as you add more types, each successive type doesn't add any more than 1 or 2% to the proportion of cervical cancer disease. And so ultimately you have to have many, many types, maybe 12 to 15 to affect all cervical cancers. There may be limits to how many types can be put in the vaccine, but more importantly, what's important is to identify which are the most important after 16, 18, and consider whether they should be added to future vaccines.
So are you going after 45 next?
Well, we are working on a next generation vaccine, but we are not at this point talking openly about or publicly about what types are in that next generation.
Okay. According to the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, what is the standing of their recommendation? How does that figure into insurance coverage or public health policy in the various states?
Sure, yeah. ACIP is one of the most important drivers for First of all, it's the most important driver for implementation of vaccines. What it does is it determines the standard of medical care for providers. So most providers now recognize that the ACIP has made a recommendation, and this is what's the best way to use this vaccine for public health intervention. But importantly, it does impact funding, because one of the other things that occurred on June 29th was that the ACIP voted to include Gardasil for the VSC program. The VSC is the Vaccines for Children program, which is a federal entitlement program that provides for vaccines for uninsured children in the United States.
And the presence of a vaccine on that list is decided by the ACIP's decision.
That's correct. And so they voted to include Gardasil to be in the VSC program for all 9 through 18-year-old females, and that includes the year of 18. So VSC stops once they turn 19 years of age. So that means that any uninsured female in the United States would be able to get Gardasil through the VSC program. Also, the ACIP recommendation really impacts private insurance coverage and reimbursement decisions. The majority of health plans make decisions about coverage and reimbursement based on ACIP recommendations. We already know that about 50% of the private covered lives in the United States are in health plans that have already stated publicly that they would cover Gardasil under their coverage benefits. And so we expect, you know, many more to follow. But even at this point, you know, less than a month after the ACIP, about 50% of health plans have already stated they would cover Gardasil. So you can see the importance of the ACIP recommendation in the ability to be able to implement vaccines to get it into people.
What's the cost of a course of treatment with Gardasil on the retail level?
Yeah, we announced that the cost per dose would be $120 as our catalog list price.
So that's each of the three doses required.
That's $120 per dose. That's right.
Right. So a full course treatment is $360.
That's correct.
Okay.
So there's a negotiated contract price with the CDC under the VFC program that is in the process of being negotiated now.
Just say a little bit more about how it works between and among Merck, the Vaccine for Children program, and the people who ultimately provide the treatment.
Yeah, what happens is the Vaccine for Children program, again, is a federal entitlement that funds vaccines for uninsured children. So the CDC is the one, the group, the immunization branch of the CDC manage the VSC program. And what they do is they provide VSC doses to each individual states and different projects around the country. And it's based on how those states determine what number of uninsured children exist in the state that would, and then would qualify for the doses. The vaccines themselves are actually, whether they're given by covered under private insurance under VFC, they're generally given in a provider office. So, there are many providers that give both, that have both private as well as public patients, and they give vaccine. They just get them from a different source, obviously. And then there are some vaccines that are given in public settings. But over the last, decade or so, there's been a real push to try to have all children get their vaccine through providers, and then those providers get vaccine from Merck and then get reimbursed from insurers, or they get vaccine from the state through the VSC program.
Okay. Where is this Gardasil going to be manufactured?
The majority of almost all of Merck's vaccines are manufactured in our West Point, Pennsylvania facility. We have another facility that is in Virginia that will also play a role in manufacture that will be coming on fairly soon as well.
Is production ramped up? Are you expecting any problems in making as much of this as the demand will be?
No, we actually began manufacturing the vaccine, several years ago. In a sense, we were manufacturing at risk before we even had a license, because we expected that we would need to have an adequate supply to supply a large number of cohorts, potentially even males, although we weren't sure at the time. So we have adequate supply to be able to provide the doses that have now been recommended by the ACIP.
Talk a little bit more about that, about whether males have any benefit from this vaccine.
We, as you know, the FDA license was only for females, and the reason for that is that we have not completed our efficacy studies in males. We showed data to the FDA in 9 to 15 year old males. We did studies in 9 to 15 year old males to demonstrate the vaccine safety and immunogenicity. So we know it's safe in younger males. We know that their immune response with measurement of antibodies is similar to women, but we have not demonstrated yet that if you give the vaccine to males that it actually prevents infection or disease. And we are in the middle of those studies. We hope to bring that data to the FDA as a supplemental file in the near future. So in the absence of the prevention of disease data, the FDA did not warrant us a license for that. And so we're still working on that. We believe that vaccinating males is very important. They get disease, they get warts, they get penile and anal cancers caused by HPV, and importantly, they also transmit the virus to women. And so vaccinating men will play a large role in interrupting that transmission, we believe, as well as helping to prevent disease in men in addition.
Okay. The issue has arisen of whether or not young girls of 11 and 12 should be required to have a course of Gardasil as a precondition for attending school. What's Merck's position on that, and what activities are you involved in to implement policies like that or to encourage policies like that around the country?
The requirements for school entry are issues or initiatives that occur at a state level. So that's a state-by-state-by-state initiative, and it's something that's undertaken by health departments and legislators and professional societies and the like at each and every different state. And each and every different state is totally different, as you can imagine. Our position is that we believe that any initiative at a state level that can ensure adequate funding and access to Gardasil would be important initiatives. And so we certainly support any local state level initiatives that would help to provide vaccine to people to ensure and to improve implementation.
In terms of the expense, you said that uninsured children can be receive the vaccine free of charge under the Vaccine for Children program. Is that right?
That's correct.
And children who are covered under health plans would get it as part of the standard of care under those programs.
That's also correct.
So there's no real financial impediment to having this become a universal program, then, is there?
Well, the small impediment is that there are nationwide about 10% of children fall between those two examples that you just gave. They are uninsured and then they're insured. And about 10% of children fall into a category of underinsured. They may have insurance that doesn't cover vaccines, those kinds of things.
Right.
So at the state level, the state will have to secure funding for that underinsured population in their state if they were to move forward with a school requirement. So the barrier at the state level is gaining funding for that population.
Okay. How active is Merck in lobbying states to implement a requirement that 11 to 12 year old girls have this before they can attend school?
Again, our philosophy is that we want to make sure that that vaccines are implemented, and we want to help states to enact policies that would implement funding and access. We do not go into states to pass Merck bills or anything like that. So if a state were to move forward, if a legislative group of legislators or a legislator or the health department that has regulatory authority were to want to move forward with a middle school requirement, say, for Gardasil, we would certainly support those efforts through activities at the state level. We would lobby to help ensure funding. We would lobby to get experts to testify on the behalf of the health department or legislator. So we certainly would support those initiatives. But Merck is not we do not go into a state and actually drop bills. It's our efforts are in support of the state sponsored activities.
Are you aware of any such efforts in individual states at this time?
I'm aware that many states are very interested in obviously in Gardasil, that there's an enormous amount of interest in a vaccine that prevents cancer, in this case cervical cancer, and there certainly will be states that will be looking at ways to really ensure that the vaccine can be implemented in the broadest way possible. So there are certainly states, and there are initiatives ongoing in different states to look at how to get that best done and what policies would be the best way to do that.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and that includes school requirements, but it's not exclusive to school requirements.
What are some other ways that could be encouraged other than school requirements?
Well, I think that there are some states there are a group of women legislators called Women in Government, and these are state legislators around the country who have spearheaded a campaign, an initiative to eliminate or to reduce cervical cancer, and they have set up cervical cancer task forces in many, many states. And the idea with those task forces is to identify, what's the burden of disease in those specific states, and what are policies that could be undertaken to reduce that disease. Whether it could be vaccination, it certainly involves screening and access to screening programs, because those are very important that they continue, and also includes, increased funding for any kind of programs that could potentially impact cervical cancer rates.
In addition to the benefits of reducing human suffering, what are the cost features of this treatment in terms of the overall savings it could provide to the healthcare system?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that HPV-related diseases cost the United States between $5 and $6 billion a year, and that's in direct medical costs. It doesn't even include any indirect costs, and that a lot of the costs are related to the screening programs, screening women, with finding women with abnormal Paps. There are over 50 to 60 million Pap tests are done every year. 3 to 4 million of them are abnormal. Those Pap tests have to be followed up, so women have to go back and some of them have to go for biopsies, some of them have to go for definitive therapies to remove parts of their cervix, to remove tissue which may be identified as precancer. And so there's an enormous cost in HPV-related disease, and that's cervical disease. And remember that there's enormous cost for general warts, there's enormous cost for the laryngeal infections caused by HPV. And then there are also some head and neck cancer. So Gardasil prevents four of the most important types that cause the most clinical disease, and therefore you'd expect the potential to be that there would be a great reduction in the healthcare utilization in women who've been prevented from those infections. Our health economic models suggest that vaccinating that broad group of women between, say, 11 and 26 years of age is actually cost savings compared to what we currently do, which is this current screening programs. So Gardasil is a remarkably efficient healthcare intervention in attacking HPV-related diseases.
Say something about this breakthrough in the context of criticism that not enough medical attention or enough attention of medical technology is directed towards problems that principally affect women, importantly affect women.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on women's health. I think that for years there have been groups that have been underserved, if you will, in many walks of life, including healthcare. I think that women certainly over the years represent one of those groups, although in the recent past I think there's been much more attention in women's health issues. I think one of the great opportunities that we have with Gardasil, Pap screening has had a remarkable impact on cervical cancer. Years ago, cervical cancer in the United States was one of the leading causes of cancer in women. It still is one of the leading causes of cancers worldwide because there aren't worldwide Pap screening programs in many countries. In the United States, we've greatly reduced cervical cancer rates through our Pap screening programs, and it's been a great public health intervention. But there still are many women who can't be accessed through current Pap screening programs, And my hope is that we've done better as a society at getting and delivering vaccines to particularly underserved communities, and maybe, you know, we'll be able to reach many of the underserved, you know, inner city youth, rural Appalachia. You know, you can, you know, we know that women who've come into the United States recently as immigrants are women who have not been screened as regularly. And so my hope is that the vaccine, as we've seen with other vaccines, will be able to cut across some of those healthcare disparities across you know, throughout all women of different types.
Okay, I want to ask you whether there's been much resistance that you're aware of to using Gardasil, which is obviously a very potent and effective medicine, on the grounds that doing so will encourage undesirable sexual promiscuity among women.
Now, Mark, we're going to lose Rick in 1 minute, so I just want to, you may want to repeat that question. I wanted to make sure maybe it was one of your last.
Sure, it is.
Mark, there is no information at all that supports that suggestion. I think that there have been some people that have sort of thrown that out as a hypothetical theory. And in fact, when studies have been done looking at the impact of any kind of therapeutic intervention, including vaccines or preventive intervention that are related to a sexually transmitted infection, there's no information or data to support that intervention increases sexual behaviors. My understanding is that there are many very important conservative groups, socially conservative groups, including those that have a faith-based philosophy, that have stated that they are not concerned that Gardasil would be linked to an increase in sexual promiscuity, and many of those organizations have come out with public statements in support of the availability of this vaccine for wide use.
Okay, it's an important question. Maybe we'll deal with it another time, but just briefly address the issue of whether Merck is working on additional anti-cancer vaccine programs.
Kelly, I know the answer to that, but I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
Oh.
So, even as far as HPV goes?
No, as far as other cancers that are caused by viruses.
Well, we have discussed in the past that we have at least one therapeutic cancer vaccine that's in the pipeline, but we haven't, I don't believe, Rick, that anything else in the pipeline has been discussed at this point.
Okay, that's why I wanted to turn to you, because that was my understanding as well.
So we, in the years to come, we might hear news of additional anti-cancer vaccines.
We have a commitment to our cancer franchise at Merck, and hopefully we'll be able to provide you with robust information on both drugs and vaccines as we move into the future.
Sounds good. Just wrap up by telling us how important you think this vaccine is going to be.
I think this is one of the most important public health advances and interventions that we are going to see, that we've seen in the last several decades, and we will see. This is a remarkable achievement to identify a viral cause of a cancer that can be prevented through vaccination is just a remarkable achievement. And in really a fairly short time period, I think it's going to be one of the most important things that I've seen in my time as a public health advocate and vaccinator.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time to explain more about Gardasil to our listeners.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate your time as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.